Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 53 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, novelist and classicist Elizabeth Speller talks to George Miller about her non-fiction books, including a biography of the Roman Emperor Hadrian and a family memoir, The Sunlight on the Garden.
My name is George Miller, and I'm very pleased to say that my guest in this programme is award-winning poet, classicist and novelist Elizabeth Speller. Since studying classics as a mature student at Cambridge, Elizabeth has written four non-fiction books. The first, a biography of the 2nd century Roman Emperor Hadrian, grew out of her postgraduate research. Mary Beard hailed it as a clear-headed and accessible narrative of Hadrian's wandering reign, informed and enlivened by some of the best modern work on the politics of the Roman Empire. This was followed by cultural historical companion guides to Rome and Athens, and a memoir, Sunlight on the Garden. Marion Keyes compared reading this memoir of Love, War and Madness to opening a jewellery box packed with beautiful unusual gems, and Victoria Glendinning praised its enthralling mixture of social history and intimacy, tragedy and humour. A few years ago, Elizabeth switched to fiction, since when three very warmly received novels have appeared. The first two volumes in a trilogy set in the period following the First World War have so far been published, The Return of Captain John Emmett and The Strange Fate of Kitty Easton, as well as most recently a freestanding novel, At Break of Day, set during the Battle of the Somme and tracing the fates of four very different young men. Elizabeth writes on her website, "I work in a restored shepherd's hut in an old apple orchard on the edge of a Cotswold valley, and in a small cottage on the Ionian island of Paxos. This interview was recorded in Elizabeth's Cotswold garden, within sight of the shepherd's hut, in the summer of 2013. In this first part of our conversation, we talk mainly about Elizabeth's non-fiction books, and in the second, we turn to the novels. I began by asking Elizabeth how far back she could trace the desire to be a writer.
In the sense of wanting to be a writer and be a published writer, that probably came quite late. Writing itself, I did as soon as I could pick up a pencil, I think. I always expressed myself in writing rather than speech, and I was an only child. My parents had me very young at university. I was an only child until I was 7. I didn't go to school. I had a governess. I was quite an isolated child, but I think I would have written anyway. I had, and still have, a slight speech impediment and a slight lisp, so I was a bit self-conscious when I was small. So I wrote and wrote and wrote, and when my mother died, I found in a drawer just about every single poem magazine and pompous article I'd written from the age of about 4 and a half onwards, and she kept them all. So that was quite nice to see. But I think if you write, you often write because you have to, with a few exceptions. The other motivations aren't as strong.
You said you didn't have an early desire, especially to be a published writer. So when did that begin to seem like a realistic desire to pursue?
I had the advantage that other people in my family were writers and artists. So I certainly knew my uncle was a Scottish writer called James Kennaway, and our families really lived together, and our houses were adjacent, and we went on holiday together. So I knew people could be writers, and he was writing in the days when they could be writers and quite well off and comfortable. So it wasn't that. It's quite a leap from writing as self-indulgent, sort of semi-diary, to thinking somebody might pay to read it. And I think that happened. I started writing copy for Pi television, and there were terrible labels about for you to have remote control, which was a new idea. So we say armchair comfort viewing and things. I wrote those labels. Then I wrote copy for a travel brochure. Finally, I went to Cambridge very late as a mature student in my very late 30s. And I think there it just gave me the confidence. I was told I could write better than a lot of other people. Not necessarily the academic content, just that I wrote more fluently. And I started to realise that it was just possible that I could do little articles, little pieces for local paper. Once you've been paid a couple of times, the whole equation changes, actually. And you think, my words could be money. I had a great advantage of also, when I was at Cambridge, realising that there really were no other career options, because I'm incredibly bad at maths. So I couldn't be Even a teacher, I'd have problems. So writing became a stronger and stronger, commercial writing became a stronger and stronger possibility for me.
When it came to putting together ideas for your first book, was it clear that it was going to be about the ancient world? You said you were studying classics, so was that a foregone conclusion?
Well, I was a single mother. I went to university. I'd had children very young. I went to university at the same time as my two elder children, not the same university. And I went on to a postgraduate degree and then continued to do a PhD. I was really seriously running out of money when the subject I was writing about was sort of ancient Roman emperors, which did have some general interest because of Robert Graves and people like that. And I made an approach. Somebody introduced me to an agent. She suggested it was very easy. It isn't easy for most people. For me, the first agent I was introduced to took me without the book. I then turned most of my PhD into a book and got paid instead of getting a PhD.
So what attracted you to Hadrian then, both as a subject for research and a subject for your first book?
I slightly wish it hadn't been my first book, because there are things you learn when you write books, and that was to a degree quite experimental. I was learning about how to write a full-length book, because you sign this contract. Given I hadn't finished my PhD, I'd never written that many words. I'd been very influenced, I was at Cambridge, read classics by Mary Beard, who thought about classics in a certain way and in very interesting ways of relating it to the modern world. But Hadrian always seemed to be the most interesting emperor, because most of the others have a sort of series of rather sort of lurid tales or inscriptions. Hadrian, personally, most of his monuments, a lot of what we see is Hadrianic. The very famous things, the Pantheon, Hadrian's Wall, right over the Mediterranean world. And he's not just a sort of patron of the arts. He's actually involved in designing these things, trying out new techniques. I also thought he was a sort of difficult, probably brilliant, lonely. So various characteristics that came out with him that really you don't see in all the orgies in Caligula or Nero. And I suppose he just appealed to me as a slightly more fleshed out character that one makes sort of slightly greater jumps about his personality and things.
And you decided not to do a conventional, what might call a sort of academic standard biographical treatment. You wanted to, I suppose, experiment with the writing of the book as well as explore the subject matter.
I think that was something I'd got from people like John Henderson and Mary Beard at Cambridge, that if you go back to the ancient world, there's so little left. At one point I was thinking, how many fragments, you know, how much are we looking at? If you look at texts and inscriptions, how much do we actually have? And I wrote to the then chair of the faculty, Keith Hopkins, who's now dead, and I said, how much do you think is left? And he wrote back in about 20 minutes saying 1/12. I thought, I was frightfully impressed, and I thought, 1/12, I put that in my book. And later on I told another academic, and she said, of course he hadn't a clue. Of course he wrote back immediately, nobody has any idea what's left. But the point was, it's a ridiculous question, but there's very little. So everyone's got these pieces. It's a mosaic that you're assembling. There are some fixed points. And then sometimes you dig something wonderful up, like the Oxyrhynchus papyri, and you really have a bit more to go on. But that's why it's very interesting. You can write a novelist, you can write crime fiction. People have Lindsay Davis, obviously. It allows a lot of movement because there isn't that much. The substance is spread out.
That first book, Lizzie, entailed travel as part of the research, and indeed part of the purpose of the book, which has been a theme, I guess, of the research of several of your books.
I think the first book partly was chosen by the fact that I already liked travel, and I'd always got caught in this thing of being caught between the wish to explore and terrible homesickness, and I was caught in the sort of tension between the two, sort of trying to find places to go where I would feel slightly melancholy. And for some reason, I thought I recognised that in Hadrian, that he kept travelling, not quite doing a geographical, because it was sort of circular, but sort of certainly sort of nostos and, you know, luxuriating in nostalgia and always being slightly out of place. So possibly it was the reason I chose my first subject, and indeed the previous subject, my PhD, and then it was a habit that paid quite well with all my books, I think. And somebody said to me quite recently that they thought that place was the biggest character in all my books. That's what I was really interested in, which is probably an accurate reflection of my own character, and probably is a thread that goes through all the different sort of genre that I've played with.
And I suppose embarking on any writing project involves discoveries. You don't know exactly what you're going to find before you set off, but that is all the more evident if you're actually physically relocating yourself in order to write.
It is. I mean, and recently I went to Rome because I wanted to. It's always both sort of more and less than you think. You go to find some famous site that's associated with them that you know you've got to see, and there are only sort of 5,000 other people there. Now, sometimes that works. You get Hadrian's Villa at Tivoli. It's visited. It's well known. It is still extraordinarily atmospheric and fantastic. But I went to find, I was writing a book set in the rise of Mussolini, and I wanted to try and see where on the Tiber his leading young and very brave opponent was abducted and killed. And I went up and down one of the more boring stretches of the Tiber, where there was an underpass and you're just about to give up and you really can't see where it would have been. And then suddenly there's a little dip and there's a monument, and it suddenly changes completely. And you look around, you could see the road he'd come up, see his last view when he must have realised. I stood there and thought, this is where he realised he made a misjudgment.
Do you ever, though, Lizzie, reach some historically significant site full of expectation and then just fail to feel any connection with it?
I think that would be more about how I was feeling when I saw it. And on the whole, I'm probably over imaginative about places. There are one or two I haven't been to because I think I might be disappointed. But usually I find just being on a place, particularly if it hasn't changed a lot, so you think this is the view, whether it's, I don't know, Mozart's flat in Vienna or standing on a bit of beach where there's been a great sea battle and thinking, well, actually, those mountains, everything, they would have seen it like that. On Ithaca, I found myself not even thinking about Odysseus and things. I think, no, you know, that is too unlikely. And I don't feel any sense of connection with that particular ancient past there. But on the whole, I think I have quite a strong sense or a strong imagination about sense of place.
And when you're there, are you taking notes then, or are you just remembering it for later recollection?
I used to entirely remember it because I'd done this travel brochure writing to start with. I used to remember it until I started making some terrible mistakes, because once you'd seen sort of 15 villas at Facey aside, trying to remember when you got home which one was which. Then I started taking photographs occasionally. I rarely do that for my own writing, because I think if you start to see how things look visually, you forget how they feel in a way that you'd like to write about them. So on the whole, I just keep it in mind, and it's often something very tiny that you remember, not the great sort of panorama or something.
With your next two books, you were explicitly evoking that sense of place in the ancient world, because you wrote two guidebooks to Athens and to Rome.
Yes, that was quite fun. Athens, I think, was particularly particularly fun because of the point at which I was asked, where I was recommended by somebody else, and I'd read classics and I'm postgraduate and stuff and had written about travel, and I'd never actually been to Athens, which was one of the factors which I don't think people really realised. But nevertheless, I thought I could compromise on this. I had at one point written in my travel writing days, I'd written about a skiing holidays, and I'd certainly never skied, which I hadn't told them either. And so I thought, well, I can do Athens. And I went there for a month, full of prejudices shared by many British people that it would be dirty and noisy and unpleasant. And it was marvellous. It was absolute revelation to me. So in some ways, I was coming with classical knowledge, but with a tourist's eyes who's arriving somewhere and is confused by, you know, quite a muddled city and peeling off the layers. So I knew what to look for.
And did you find the right kind of voice, the right kind of register for writing about ancient Athens quite quickly? Did you know what kind of guide you wanted to be for the traveller?
I think I wanted to be the sort of guide for the traveller who quite likes getting lost, who might like to go to a place and wander. I'm probably less one who wants to say, well, I'm going to see the 4-star sites first and then 3-star, and then if I'm not too tired, I'll see the 2-star. I prefer to think of, well, you walk down here and you'll see something magnificent here, something here that you won't even read about, but isn't it curious? An ancient drain head or something. And I certainly felt I wrote the guidebook I'd like to have, and it is one I still get many emails about. And the competition tended to be either fairly lightweight tourist guides or very serious archaeological guides. Mine really was about, well, if you go to this cafe and then you wait till an hour and you'll see the sun do this, or there's a shoemaker here, or, you know, a particularly good banjo player. And that's the way I would like to look at a city. I was still quite pleased with it. It was also sort of in fragments. So there were bits of poetry and bits from old texts and bits from advertisements and things that, even factors, I like to know that the number of cigarettes Greeks smoke. I was very amused to find their frequent flyer program is called the Icarus program. There were sort of all sorts of wonderful things that you discover when you get to know a city. And one of the great things of Athens is it's not a European city. It's not a generic city. It's Athens. And so that's really nice to write about.
And what about Rome? I mean, there's so much more that's been written about Rome since the ancient world than about Athens. Did you have a sense of an impossible city to try to capture in a short book?
I think it's a city you can only contribute to what's already there. You're going to it with, you know, so many eminent writers, and in fiction and in poetry and diaries. All writers like Dickens, Eliot, everybody's been there commenting on it. And then, of course, on top of that, you have the guidebooks. So you add to it. And that way, not quite as satisfactory to me as Athens, where I felt I was on quite new ground. And the difficulty in Athens was to please the Greeks, because I was well aware that they have a way of seeing themselves that I had to represent, even if I might not see them the same way all the time. And they did like it. They put it on the Olympic site. In Rome, that they would be indifferent to how yet another writer would see their city. So it's quite a different experience, although it shares being unique. I think Rome is absolutely, it is just Rome.
And if I were to ask you for a top tip for each city, a place that you think is underrated or little known, or a particular favourite, or a particular time of day for seeing, are there any things which really stick in your mind, or perhaps just very memorable moments in the research when you were based in those cities?
I think in Athens there were two. One was the Theatre of Herodes Atticus, which is at the foot of the Acropolis and had connections with Hadrian. The man was a friend of Hadrian's. And I went to an opera there to see Samson and Delilah, which was a very sort of orientalized production of it. And I sat there in the night and you could hear dogs barking, owls, people finding themselves in their programmes, and you suddenly think, this is how it was 2,000 years ago. People sat here and watched performances. Yes, undoubtedly they were mic'd, but that wasn't obtrusive. Actually, the acoustic was very good. So that was absolutely wonderful. It was really hot, and there was this music, and there was Athens. And then another evening I went up to, sort of connected to actually the monument to a friend of Hadrian's, Julius Babilis, and it was sort of higher than the rest of the city. Went up there. It was just about to be sunset. There were clearly two or three other people who knew about this because they were sitting up there too. And as the sun went down, then slowly the lights of Athens all came on. You could see the lights, and then you could see the coast. You could see the Acropolis, and you could see why this city-state became powerful, because it was both defended geographically and access to the sea. You don't see that anywhere else. And then to my amusement, I having read 101 Dalmatians, and you remember this, the twilight barking, as the lights came on, these dogs, as far as you could hear, dogs were barking and howling as the lights came, and as the day faded. So it was sort of a mixture of amuse me and quite profound. It was an insight into why Athens worked as it did.
And what about a Roman example?
I mean, Rome's harder because so much is labelled, but I think I only returned quite recently to check that it was still as perfect. If you go behind the church of St. Maria della Pace, which is near the Piazza Navona, you go to Piazza Navona, which is utterly beautiful and utterly full of tourism, and get your portrait painted, and you know, there's silent statues and things. There's moving people who don't move. You turn off, you see the church at Santa Maria del Pace, which is invariably closed. But if you go down the side, you can go into this Bramante cloister, the first one he designed in 1500. And it's silent. It's just pigeons. There are the cells. You walk up little stairs, which are sort of deeply worn stone stairs. And you can actually have a coffee, rather nice coffee, up at the top, sitting in these stone seats where the monks sat. And it's sort of timeless. And yet it's only yards from the bustle of Piazza Navona. So I love that. And I do love the Appian Way. Sort of going down a road that you can see the carts that brought the stone in. They've left their tracks, you know, over thousands of years. And all the armies have come down. And I was quite pleased to find that the American army, when they were coming to relieve the Allies generally, when they were coming to relieve Rome at the end of the Second World War, rerouted
so that they could enter the city down the Appian Way as a sort of symbolic gesture. I quite like the idea of them going in the sun, being told to move 2 miles so they could come in a better road. So the Appian Way is absolutely beautiful.
So there you are, 3 books in, all of them on the ancient world in biography and sort of historical guidebook writing. But were you also writing in other genres at the same time? I know that you write poetry as well, and your next book was a family memoir. So were you experimenting with these things at the same time as you were doing the classical research?
I mean, I think I always was, because none of them are true strictly to genre. I mean, the first book, Hadrian, I interspersed a fairly standard account of Hadrian's travels with a completely fictionalized diary by a woman we know was in his court, and she was a poet, and we do have some of her engravings on things, but she left no other traces. So I had her writing a diary, which sort of undercut, subverted some of the narrative of Hadrian, you know, what was actually like to be trekking around after a powerful monarch, in effect, de facto monarch. And the guidebooks, as I say, they weren't ones you'd want to go without a map. Anyway, I can't tell left from right. So none of them were strictly within genre, and I'd always written poetry, but clearly you can't live on it. So actually the memoir was sort of continuing that, I think. You know, was it really a memoir? In some ways it was a a social history. In some ways I had to speculate about what somebody thought. I wasn't there to make the narrative flow. And I included bits of poetry and songs and contemporary sort of references, I think some newspapers. I think it's just quite a way I like writing, really.
So what impelled you to start the memoir? And was it something that you thought of as being for publication from the start, or were you simply exploring and seeing where it took you?
I think, you know, probably we're all quite sort of sophisticated. You start writing and then you start to see the sort of things you're interested in, and then perhaps you start to think about, why do I like this? So there was that aspect of where am I coming from on this? You know, a lot of people in my family had followed sort of fairly creative careers. I'd had quite serious problems with depression in my 20s and early 30s, so had several members of my family. I was thinking about the link between sort of creativity and depression, I suppose, and that expanded. I also inherited from various sources, or when I was younger, stole from people like my grandparents books and diaries that fascinated me, that I sort of suddenly acquired this huge number of documents that I just liked as a little girl. And as I got older, I realised that books, diaries people had kept at the beginning of the First World War, or letters people had exchanged when they were about to get divorced in the 1920s, actually were the most fantastic source. So the historian in me thought, I have to do something with all this material.
But did you think when you set out that this may take me to places which are too personal to ever make public?
I think perhaps writers are more selfish than that. I thought about it towards the end, and my mother was dead, and I might have written it. I wouldn't have published it, I think, while she was alive. The rest of my family, I asked my children. I didn't give it to them to read, but they were aware there were going to be some bits they might find difficult. But I also hoped it was quite funny in some places and quite interesting. The people who've written to me on that one, a lot of them are my sort of age, say, this is the experience of a lot of us sort of middle-class children born after the First World War. After the Second World War in the 50s and early 60s, we share a lot in upbringing. I think the war had made quite a conformist way of being and being educated. Even our toys, so I recognise that, or I remember having a bomb shelter in the garden, or I remember the bomb sites. And this sense of something pretty bad that had happened, that our parents had obviously been affected by, that wasn't talked about much. And yet we were growing up into the "you never had it so good" Britain, and that really interested me. How many people felt that they'd just come after something vast. And anyway, we'd followed 2 generations who'd had to fight. So it was, in every sense, for a historian, for somebody who's too imaginative, it was a fantastic subject. So I think I do actually think of it as a microhistory. But clearly you talk about being depressed, you talk about disruptions in your family, unhappinesses in the past. But there's also, I think, quite a lot of joy and quite a lot of sort of just things that are amusing, or just sort of serendipity or curious. I don't think it's dismal. I wouldn't say it's a misery memoir.
So you wouldn't make a sort of radical distinction between writing that book and writing other books, where there's less ostensibly of yourself in the foreground? It's a question of degree. It's not a question of kind.
I think people are very present in their books. Those people where I know the writer, the authors, and I know the books, whether or not they think they are or not, they're in their books. It's very hard not to be. Just if you write more than, say, three books, there are themes you can see people returning to and examining and exploring. And I suppose I did it more overtly in a memoir, but I can see when I write my novels, I can see things come out. The same things come out in every book I write. Not necessarily things I think are particularly significant, but they're certainly repeating themselves.
Are these things entirely subconscious that you only see when you go back? You think, ah, oh, there's a sort of fingerprint that I've left there.
The ones that fascinate me are subconscious, because if I want to write about that book, I wanted to say, perhaps there was this sort of slight polemic, and I say, I come from a family where quite a lot of people struggled with depression, and quite a lot of people were creative, and where's that going? That was quite conscious. These are things that come out, and I suddenly, oh my God, this has been, every single book I've written has had X in. People are going to think I've got an issue with it, and there are things I don't think I've got an issue with. And at one point, my poetry was set for one of the papers at Cambridge for undergraduates, and it was for a trial paper. And a friend of mine later showed me, she said, a couple of years past, would you like to see sort of the essays that they were writing? And they'd seen things in my poetry that I hadn't intended to be in there, but they were right.
Give me an example.
They said that they thought that there was, in my background, there was somebody who was concerned about illness. And clearly, I thought about illness and impending death, and they suspected that a lot of them were about the process of accepting death. Now, my mother, who died at 62, was dying when I wrote those. These poems were not about her, not about those subjects. Several of the more astute ones had picked that up, that a lot of my metaphors unintentionally led to decay and deterioration of vigour. And I looked at them again and I said, yes, I can see it. But it's made me laugh when we all rather sort of, if you've done A-level English or English university, you say, oh, you know, you don't know, it's nothing to do with where the writer is, and it's just look at the text. I was thinking they were doing Prakrit, but everything they said was right.
Is there a degree to which, though, you don't want to be too conscious of those things? You just want those things to emerge, to bubble up of their own accord and not be too aware of what might be in the background?
The book I'm writing at the minute, I was thinking, you know, well, what am I going to do with my chap? I won't have to have my hero sort of slightly on the run at one point. So I thought, oh, this is terrific. And he's in Rome. Clearly, he will go down the catacombs, because that would be really very interesting if he did that. And I thought, every single book I've written has had people underground in small spaces. I'm not claustrophobic. I don't mind going underground. And yet I keep going back to this. And so for a joke, I sort of thought, well, what things do come up in all my books? And then I read, all my books have something about the classics. Fair enough, I read classics. All my books have something about poetry. Fair enough, I write poetry. All my books have something about the relationships between fathers and children. And I have an extremely nice father and a very uncomplicated relationship with him. They all go underground. They all have fire in them. And you think, you know, is this actually just coincidence? But then one or two other people have emailed me saying, well, they see these themes in my books. I could see if I was become terribly famous and be analysed, there would be people doing PhDs on images of the subterranean. So I'm just desperately trying to find exciting things that don't quite follow this to type. And what I don't seem to write about very much is motherhood. And yet I am a mother and, I'm interested in it, but I've never found myself writing about it. And as I'm somebody who tends to not think about what I'm writing beforehand, it sort of just evolves. It isn't somewhere I seem to want to go.
That was Elizabeth Speller in conversation with George Miller. You can find out more about Elizabeth on her website at www.elizabethspeller.com, and you'll be able to hear the second part of this interview in episode 57. And that concludes episode 53, which was recorded and produced by George Miller. Coming up in episode 54, we take an inside look at how writers navigate the shoals of literary genre in My True Genre. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.